Today's segment of Defenders Live was pre-recorded on May 3rd, 2012, and is part one of a two-part show.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.
I think that you also have the right framework for understanding a lot of what is the bigger issues around this story. And I mean, honestly, one of the things that's interesting is just how a novel gets positioned and who can appreciate those larger repercussions as opposed to the way that different kinds of books get looked at for different mm-hmm. who the audience will be or what issues they do or don't raise.
Right. And the availability that we have to information, even when it's not so much. I mean, one of the little sort of factoids about Mary Bowser we've heard is that she had a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. And that was why she was able to do what she did the way she was able to do it. But to even have that means that suddenly we have a billion more sparks to trigger, whatever engages us personally with the story and whatever we might know about the context and whatever story we want to tell using our history. Because we keep saying to people, in particular, in our say, reclamation of Richmond's African burial ground and the idea of Sankofa, going back to get the knowledge that you need in order to move forward, it's still about, what story do we want to tell? What, how many stories about the same person can you tell because that person represents so many different things to so many different people?
There was a wonderful professor. He was one of the founding professors of what was then called the Afro-American Studies Department at Harvard, Nate Huggins. And in writing about Sally Hemings, he said, this is a story that will always be symbolically true for the Black community, even if it can't be proven literally true.
That's right.
That symbolically, the Black community finds in the story of Sally Hemings and her children by Thomas Jefferson a place for themselves in the founding of the American nation. Nate Huggins died before the DNA testing was developed that definitively proved mm-hmm. that Sally Hemings did have children by Thomas Jefferson. And so he never saw that symbolic history become proven history. Mm-hmm. But I think that the point that he makes extends well beyond Sally Hemings, that symbolic history mm-hmm. isn't necessarily the same as falsehood. Mm-hmm. And symbolic history symbolic history works all the time for around lives that are better documented.
It does.
And it is certainly the truth that we remember some people's lives who are well documented with inaccuracies in there. Mm-hmm. Jefferson's own life, the resistance of some people to accepting that evidence about him having children with Sally Hemings is that level of resistance is a different kind of symbolic history.
That's right.
But I do think that I certainly have taken the photographic memory as one of those places where there are claims, but there's no proof of that. And it seems hard to believe, given the nature of photography, the time that she was doing this, that they would have conceptualized it as photographic memory.
Yeah, that's
but
right.
I use that in a very early scene in the novel. It's a scene that I have been doing at readings, where she hears Bette Van Loo. She and her mother are waiting on table on Bette and her mother while they're having breakfast one morning, and Bette reads from the newspaper to her mother every morning, and Mary remembers the story and later starts saying it out loud, and everybody thinks that she's reading, which causes a huge uproar, as you might imagine. Mm-hmm. And what happens when they realize that even more powerful than the ability to read is this ability to remember everything
yes.
that she sees or hears.
Yes.
But when I'm doing that reading, I always start by saying to the audience, every child wants to believe that she or he is special. And every parent wants to believe that their child is special. But when you were enslaved, being special was dangerous. And so I think that that helps us to reach across time, to reach across legal status, to reach across race and culture, so that any of us can imagine not what it would be like to step back into their world, but what it would mean to have our feelings, our emotions, our desires, and live under the constraints that they lived under. So every parent does want their child to be special. What would it be like to have those feelings under the institution of slavery, knowing what special could possibly mean for your child?
That's a very good point. That's very, yeah. Mary Bowser was young when she sort of disappears off the radar of anyone's sort of concrete knowledge of her existence. All I know or think I know is that she left after the Civil War was over and went north, and that we don't know where she is buried. There's some rumor of a pension for services rendered or not.
I haven't heard that. I can tell you a little bit about her life after the Civil War. And this is all very new information. Some of it touched on in the work of other historians and some that I have just uncovered. And this is, again, I've become so interested in her story, and in part separating the fact from fiction. Clearly, I've chosen fiction, but there's much that is put out there as fact about her that isn't true. Mm-hmm. But there are also some facts that aren't known. After the war, she went on a lecture tour to the North. Mm. She appeared under a false name. Mm. She used the name Richmonia Richards.
Oh, wow.
So Richmonia showing that she still identified with Richmond as her home city. Right. And Richards was actually a name that she had used earlier in her life, and that Bette Van Leeuw, we know this from Bette Van Leeuw's correspondence, before the war, she refers to Mary Richards. So before she's married to Wilson Bowser, she's Mary Richards. So she reclaims that name, and I actually have an account in a Black newspaper from New York of a speech that she gave in New York in October of 1865, talking to the Black community there. Mm. And she is funny. Mm-hmm. She is willing to tell people, this is what you should be doing. She says, you know, you young people should spend more time on education and less time on fashion.
Oh my
which
God.
Seems to be advice that extends across the ages.
Wow.
So, and then after that, she goes back to the South and first in Florida, first in Richmond and then in Florida and then in Georgia, works in some of what were called the Freeman schools, the schools that were set up for African Americans. And I have read, only quite recently did I unearth these letters that she wrote to the person who was the superintendent of education for the Freeman schools in all of Georgia. So these are letters in her own hand where she's talking about what it was like to be in a very isolated community, setting up the first school that any Blacks there had ever had any access to.
Wow.
And how grateful the community is, how poor the community is, how vulnerable the community is. That there's one point where she says, you know, I've been a spy and I'm used to studying people's faces, and I can tell you that there are white people here who are just waiting for their opportunity to do something bad to this community. And she's quite fearful. And it is, I think, a really stark reminder that the end of slavery and the end of the war was not the end of the vulnerability for individuals and for whole communities throughout what had been the slaveholding states.
Right. And in fact, some would argue that that vulnerability was increased dramatically because they were no longer tied as property needing protection to owners.
Yeah. So, you know, and she disappears out of the historical record not long after that. So after about 1867, I have no idea where she goes or what she does, but I think that I will admit I end my novel on a more hopeful note mm-hmm. than getting into that period of what's called the nadir in Black history, the end of the 19th century when the real, as you say, the terrorism outside of the status of properties takes hold.
Right. Yeah. And that is a whole other chapter in Virginia. And by virtue of that, you know, a whole other chapter for the United States. It's there was a writer that that really sort of helped to flip my switch in the 1990s, and this was a Japanese-American writer, actually Okinawan, but Ronald Takaki, who mm-hmm. wrote about multiculturalism from the perspective of Asians coming in through Hawaii and California and their experience as immigrants and workers. In the West of the United States, and how he in his book The Different Mirror in particular sort of talks about each wave of immigrant community that's brought in and the experiences that each one has as a result of the role that they play in undermining the last.
Yes.
As workers who have, you know, found a place, carved out a place, and begun to develop some strength, some community, and in some circumstances begun to build bridges between each other, and then the disempoweringment of that by bringing in a new group of immigrants and giving them preference. Yeah.
Well, W.E.B. Du Bois has a novel. He's not generally known as a novelist. Perhaps it is my own novelist stance that makes me champion him in that regard. But he's a novel called The Quest for the Silver Fleece. And sort of it's set in the South. I haven't read it. It's been many years. It's set in the South in the period after the Civil War. It sort of imagines what would have happened if poor whites and newly freed blacks had been able to sort of come together in terms of their own interest in as members of the working class. That, of course, most whites in the South did not benefit from slavery, that those who owned slaves, especially those who owned many slaves, were a small portion of the white community.
That's right.
And for whites who weren't slaveholders, it was extremely difficult to compete economically against slaveholders.
That's right.
So that slavery did not advantage and, in fact, disadvantaged those whites. It's part of the reason that in other parts of the United States, as new states were being brought into the Union, there were anti-slavery sentiment. It wasn't necessarily an objection to the wrongness of slavery on moral grounds, but an awareness that economically it would be much more difficult for other whites to compete if those who had the resources to own slaves had the ability to own slaves.
Yeah.
So that's a complicated piece of the history, but it is an interesting question about why some critical legal scholars call the investment in whiteness, or the idea of whiteness as property. That is to say, my whiteness is something I have that I believe makes me separate from and better than mm-hmm. a person of color, is a way to keep me from building, as you say, important bridges from one group to another that mm-hmm. actually could advantage everybody.
Yeah. And it is interesting how in the 20th century, when as unions were coming together, and particularly in the first half of the 20th century, that solidarity, the great struggles there as well for those same exact reasons, but when they did come together, when people came together as workers under the framework of the union activities, you began to encounter what really sometimes feels like an incredibly enlightened population.
Yeah.
Because they saw it. It's like all of a sudden we experience it. I have more in common with you than I have with the boss, you know, and it doesn't matter if we're the same race. It doesn't even matter if we might be distant cousins, you know, from back.
Right.
I have more in common with you, you know, a black worker on the line with me than I have with them. And therefore it is in our interest to work together.
And I think that the flip side, the inverse is also unfortunately true, that I think one of the pieces of Civil War history that is surprising to people is to learn about some of the draft riots in the North,
oh, yeah.
where whites, largely Irish immigrants, were basically committing huge acts of violence against free black communities in places like New York City because of their own fears about what it meant to be drafted in the Civil War.
That's right.
Now, the larger context of that history is that the draft, people could buy their way out of the draft.
That's right.
So poor people were more likely to be subject to the draft than wealthy people. And so that, again, that those larger class issues play out in ways that turn people against each other who we might like to see have more solidarity.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, I think the that's part of the history of I'm not seeing it quite yet, but, you know, in Virginia, well, the country is supposed to be sort of commemorating the sesquicentennial of the Civil War at this point up through 2016. And there's a lot of things, a lot of stories that are being told, a lot of histories that are being raised up and focused on that haven't had that opportunity before. But I think this one, the one that's sort of embodied by the novel Quest for the Silver Fleece and that the dynamic of what if poor whites and blacks had actually worked together, I've heard people sort of allude to that, but I think that that's another incredibly deep and incredibly volatile aspect of the history of black-white relations that has yet to get the attention that it needs. And I think it is particularly relevant right now.
Yeah, there's a great scene that I stage in The Secrets of Mary Bowser in which, you know, it's wonderful to be a novelist. You get to put words in people's mouths.
That's right.
But where Bette and Mary have just had an encounter with some folks who are part of the union operation and who say things that are just incredibly racist. And Mary is hurt that Bette isn't more upset by this. Mm. But and Bette says something like, well, you know, first we have to win the war and end slavery, and then we can get around to addressing race prejudice. And from Mary's point of view, that just does it's not the same thing. It's not something that you can wait on.
That's right.
And so I think that just that question of sort of at what moment do we come out from slavery and where does redressing start to happen? And in fact, in reality, just trying to bring the country together, there was a lot of debate about to what extent should there be forgiveness over punishment in terms of the secessionists and what needed to happen to breach the war itself as the great horror, as opposed to slavery as the great horror. And I think that that is another thing that kind of ideologically and politically shapes that period, as well as the economic questions that we talked a little bit about.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. I don't want to bring this to an end, but
you and I should have had a slumber party. I could have talked all night.
I'm telling you, that may be the next iteration of Defenders Live. I'm thinking, you know, and I like that title. We're going to call it the Slumber Party for Social Justice, you know, or something. I don't know. But I am going to have to bring it to an end. But this was really, really good, and I have to run out and get the book and actually read it so that I can.
Well, let me say one more thing.
Yeah, please do.
You can work with it or not. I mean, you asked me about what we know of this woman's life beyond the Civil War, and I know a few facts. The title of the book is The Secrets of Mary Bowser. And I think in some ways I've grown to like the richness of that title more and more because in some ways she is still keeping secrets from us. And of course that makes sense. I would argue that to some sense, every slave was a spy. That is to say, every slave was living a life of surreptition because to survive slavery, you had to do things beyond what you were ordered to do and allowed to do.
That's right.
And so I argue every slave is a spy, but every spy also is used to living a life of surreptition. And after the war, she's very cagey about what she tells people and what she doesn't, and when she uses a pseudonym and when she doesn't, even after the war is over. Mm-hmm. I think that keeping secrets had become a mechanism of survival for her that she had relied on her whole life. And so although I do wish that we knew more, I also have to respect the way in which it was probably very telling that Mary Bowser is still keeping her secrets from us.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you would make that as the last point, in part because it reminds me of a conversation that I had with my father a couple years ago, when I made the discovery that, you know, there were communities that, small Black communities and townships that formed defense committees and, you know, looked after themselves, and that in the face of the perception that the Black community was always subject to being victimized and arbitrary violence and things which are true, there were also communities which organized themselves to defend themselves to the extent that after dark, whites would not want to find themselves, you know, in the wrong neighborhood or in the, you know, on the wrong edge of a small town, or try to perpetrate any violence, because that was a community that was going to respond immediately and effectively to protect itself. And I was like, well, I want to tell that story. I want to, you know, talk more about it. Why don't we hear more about it? And he said, because you aren't supposed to know. And I was like, what? How can you say that to me? You know, but it was a great way to have a ton of bricks, you know, fall on my head and remind me how important those secrets were to people's survival.
Yeah. Yes. A life of surreptition was the only way to survive, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Well, go out and read the book. I hope that you will like it and recommend it to people. And I want to see how much it rings true for somebody who walks the streets of Richmond regularly.
Yeah. You'll have to come back, because this place will, you know, make you tremble the more you know about it. And the points at which you begin to recognize how much of the historic layers of Richmond still exist, and that we put our feet on them every day. Right. It's truly compelling and truly representative, I think, of these kinds of experiences across. Yeah. Now you're going to have to be very specific with me. What is it that you do not want unaired?
I think the part about her, whatever her relationship was to this man for whom we have a marriage record, by the time the war was over, that relationship was over.
Okay.
And that's not something that is generally noted places.
Right. Okay. And you're talking about Mr. Bowser.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And you'll see in the book, I'm cagey even. I'm one of those people who hates to read a movie review that gives away any of the plot.
Yeah.
So there are a few Bowsers in this text who are real people. And, you know, that's one of the places I do invention. I talk about, because a chunk of this novel is set in Philadelphia. David Bastille Bowser was a real person, a member, a very prominent member of the Free Black community in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Wilson Bowser was a Free Black man in Richmond. I get to invent the fact that they were cousins, but they were both real people. Mm-hmm, I just make them cousins.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, we really can't slumber party because you have other things to do today, don't you?
I kind of do. But I reserve the right to call you sometime.
Anytime. This has been a blast. And, you know, if you know of other folks who would be interested in these kinds of interviews, this is not the first place that mainstream publishers think about.
Right.
But it's really clearly really important to me in the kind of work I'm doing with the novel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I will. Absolutely. This is great. Okay. Yeah, we have a newspaper also. Sorry, I'm going to get all giddy because I'm getting off the air. But we also have a newspaper, a local community newspaper that sort of goes statewide. So chances are I'm going to write about the fact that I'm doing these interviews and talking about these issues with writers. And I think it's a compelling new layer for the show.
It's been such a pleasure to get to talk to you about these things. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure for me as well. I don't get to have these kind of conversations very often, and it is a pleasure. So I thank you for being willing to go through this with us.
Oh, absolutely. It's wonderful to find the local community excited, as I said, about someone that I would have to call a national hero.
Yeah, no kidding. And we get to put her right in there with the books released about Gabriel and about some other deeper issues this year. So it's a good year. This is all coming together just like it's supposed to. So I'm really happy about that. Yeah. And so I look forward to you coming to Richmond at some point. And
I think I probably will be there in the next few months at some point. I will certainly let you know.
Very good. Very good. Is there any, while we're on the air also, is there any contact information, or do you want to refer people to, you know, your website or something?
Sure.
Like
so
that?
Folks can find out more about the novel and some of the history behind the novel at my website, which is www.loislevine.com, LOISLEV as in victory, EEN as in Nancy.com. I also have a Facebook page, but I think the folks who are interested in the history will find that my personal website has some articles that I've done about the Black community in Richmond and other issues about Richmond during the Civil War that will help, I think, fill in some of what folks may not know and be very interested in.
That's great. Thank you very much, Lois.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.